I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to History Rage, the podcast where we invite our leading historians to unleash their own personal incendiary firestorms. The podcast where we precision bomb the myths back to the Stone Age. I am your regular host, Paul Baffle, and I am flying solo on this mission tonight because Kyle has got to get herself sorted for our grand appearance at We Have Ways Fest, which no doubt we'll tell you about well before you've heard this. But this week, loyal listeners, if you're recovering from last week's rage on Blitzkrieg, well, we're staying in the Second World War. And joining us this week, we welcome historian, PhD candidate, and assistant lecturer at the University of Essex, James Jeffries. James, welcome to History Rage.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here. I've been looking forward to this very much.
Yeah, and in fact, you got in touch with us to say, hang on a minute, yeah. I'm pissed off about this. Let me on. Yeah. Yeah, so thank you very much for doing quite a lot of my recruitment work for me.
My pleasure.
To be fair, we have had you recommended by other aviation historians that we've had on as well. So, you know, but for those people out there that haven't crossed paths with you, first of all, could you tell us a bit about your background, your work, and how you got into this particular field of history?
So my fascination with history, sorry for those that have heard this already, but I watched the Battle of Britain film as a child, and I was obviously mesmerized by all the aircraft and all the excitement and everything going on. But yeah. I found watching it, why is this happening? What happened afterwards? There were a lot of questions. So that led to other war films. So I think I watched Dunkirk, and then I watched like The Longest Day and all this sort of stuff. That led to documentaries, to books. We'd go to, as a family, to air shows, and then we'd visit old air bases and such like. I'd get into the inevitable airfix kits and all the old cliche things to get
who
into.
It
just escalated from there. And I did history at GCSE, and I then did it at A level. But then I did drama at BA. I took a little bit of an alternate route because my A levels weren't very good.
I mean, you know, the history world is filled with drama.
You know? That's true. It's
both personal and historical, you know.
And yeah, I did a couple of outside history modules, and then I went, I never want to study again, I'm done. A few years later, twiddled my thumbs after working around, I did an MA in history, fell in love with it, and decided not to do anything else after that. So I worked for a few years and then got the bug and started my PhD. And it's just that thing that's constantly there. I've always got questions. I've always got a fascination with the air war. So my PhD thesis is looking at the British cultural memory of the Second World War. So how, especially publicly and the collective memories, how it's consumed and such like. So my most recent chapter, I'm looking at television and how that has been used as a medium, and British memories have differed to what's happening on the continent and in America and all this sort of stuff. Yeah. And it absolutely, yeah, fascinates me. And video games as well. So that's going to be one of my upcoming chapters. So there's a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah, we could talk some distance on aviation-based video games, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Although I have to say, I grew up when I was growing up from playing the video games, it were very much the First World War ones that captured me. So your Knights of the Sky, your Wings, classics like that. Yeah.
Yeah. There's about 800 called Red Baron as well.
Yeah. Okay, so let's dive into the rage then, because you've mentioned that you've quite a lot to get off your chest tonight. So will you please tell everybody out there, James, what you wish everyone would just stop believing?
Not necessarily a belief as such, but just the constant focus on the Dam Busters to the point that sometimes it feels like an obsession. Now, this isn't, I want to put a disclaimer here. It is a fascinating, incredible story. The bravery of the crews goes without saying, the ingenuity of the engineering and such like, but it seems to me to have run away from itself, that a lot of the other narratives are being ignored, are not being discussed. And this is the thing, as I say, it's a fascinating story, 617 Squadron, but other squadrons are available. There's other things to talk about. There's other raids. And recently the mass commemoration of it, obviously it was the anniversary, but I'm thinking, well, what about other things that happen, other commemorations and such? Like the repeat of the film, it's the Bomber Command film.
Yeah.
And watching it, I mean, it's iconic, isn't it? There's some incredible scenes, the empty chairs scene and such like, especially moving. And at the end where Gibson goes off, says, I need to write some letters and, you know, exactly what, you know, it's incredibly emotive. But I do have issues with the film as well and the narrative. And I think there's a reason it's got a longevity because of the music, because of there's a link to British identity to it as well. There's a sort of frustrated, charismatic professor that's bureaucracy's getting in the way of, you know, he's using marbles in his garden to work out how to destroy dams. It's that, you know, British muddling along. And of course, it wasn't quite like that. You know, everything was very methodical and such like. And it isn't a stand, this idea that it was a standalone raid in the sense of a lot of things that it ticks and covers, it's part of a wider, what is dubbed the Battle of the Ruhr. So this campaign that is to target the industrial heart of Germany, it's a part of that. It's not a standalone thing. And a lot of credit for what happens in the Battle of the Ruhr seems to be put on the Dam Busters. Well, that was the most successful, et cetera. It's like, no, this is a prolonged campaign. There's a lot more to it. There's a lot more stats. It's also not the only one at low level with a specialist bomb. You know, all this sort of stuff. So, one raid that I've talked about a few times is one which is 5 Group, which is what 617 Squadron assembled special crews. There's specially adapted bombs. It's at night over water, deep into Germany, in the Ruhr Valley. It's the raid in August 1940 at the Dortmund's End Canal. There's also a VC as well. Gibson is at the time training for it as well. And I'm just, it's not that unique. There are other ones that we can talk about that have some parallels and similarities. I've talked about raid on Augsburg in April 42, which is low level. There's a VC again.
Parallels are there, aren't they?
This is what I mean, but it seems to be like, oh, no, there's a uniqueness to the Dam Busters and it changed the war. And I mean, I'll go into more detail about that later. Also, this narrative really that Barnes Wallace, you know, this is a brainchild to go, oh, I've got this great idea to smash the dams and all this. That was immediately on the Air Ministry's radar, so to speak, to use a term, right from the start of the war. They realized that the Zorpa and Mona dams, if they breach them, it's going to cause disruption.
Yeah.
It's not this thing that's come out of thin air. And it just annoys me that there seems to be this narrative of, I don't know, absolute focus on it. As I say, it's an incredible story. This isn't anything against the crews and such, but there are some incredibly powerful stories that need to be told.
Yeah.
This is why I've never talked about the Dam Busters, or I try to avoid it because it's just done to death.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Operation Oyster. I want to talk about Peenemünde, you know, all these sort of things, because they're not getting out there. And also, I know we're going to discuss this later, but it's, the pedestal is kind of the two things to talk about when it comes to RAF Bomber Command are the Dam Busters and Dresden.
Yeah.
And they're complete opposites in terms of styles of raids, what they mean, why they resonate as well. Yeah. And there's an agenda that, oh, look, all Bomber Command did was kill women and children, which isn't the case. And I'm not for that. I'm, you know, et cetera. It's an incredibly complex thing that you can't put on a raid, on one raid at the end of the war. It's not even the bloodiest raid by far.
Yeah.
Or it's the Dam Busters. Oh, look, this is a clean destruction, et cetera, et cetera. So when there were people that were killed, and I mean, I'll go over some of the stats with that later, but there's more than meets the eye. And this kind of, I almost want to say binary memory does frustrate me. And the damn buses, I want to talk about the other rage. I want to talk about the wider story, the escalation, etc. But yeah, sorry, it's a little bit of a rage started to creep in there.
There we go. And just to carry on that theme, then what we're going to talk about first of all is, of course, the Dambusters raid, isn't it? So, you know, who doesn't love it? The ingenuity, the courage, the skill, the bouncing bombs, although technically, is it a bomb or is it really a depth charge?
And yeah, no, it's not a bomb.
Yeah, there we go. but for all that we love it, did it really achieve anything?
This is the thing. I think it has been overplayed. It's not to say that it was a complete failure, but it's not to say that, I mean, some people have suggested it's a war-winning raid, which is complete nonsense. So I'm going to, when it comes to raids, there's different ways, obviously, of measuring it. There's the material damage, there's the strategic, the tactical elements to think about. And I'm just going to go over some of the material things. Well, I've got some stats here.
Because, oh, we love stats. Come on.
So when the Mona Dam was breached, spoiler alert for anyone who doesn't know that's, I've just read the whole story for you. There are 1,294 dead, killed by the flood. 476 are German. And there are 69 others that are missing. Their remains aren't found. 593 are foreigners, mostly slave workers, Ukrainian women that are in a camp that gets flooded. So the vast majority are this. There's also French and Belgian POWs that are in the casualty figures as well that are lost. In terms of material damage, 92 houses destroyed, 32 farms damaged, 11 factories destroyed, which is one of the big things. And the stat I found quite interesting was 6,316 dead livestock, mostly cows and pigs. Not that the Ruhr Valley is really known for this. It is the factory industrial parts. But anyway, there's some stats for you. The Eder Dam, which Max Hastings dubs as was quite irrelevant to attack. And there's criticism that it was chosen because it was easier to attack than the Zorpa Dam or breach than the Zorpa Dam. Mm-hmm. I'll go into that a little bit more in a bit because they don't breach the Zorpa Dam. The bomb is not designed for that. And it does make you wonder if it had been breached, what the damage would have been. But anyway, I'll go into that in a little bit. So Eder Dam is breached. There are 47 dead, 112 houses and 101 places of work destroyed or seriously damaged. There's not a great deal of damage from it. It's quite out there. It's not really near anything really at all. And as I say, when we look at this raid, I mean, the death numbers are always horrific when you look at these raids. We compare that to July 1943, Operation Gomorrah, the bombing of Hamburg. We see between 34 and 43,000 people killed.
Yeah.
580 industrial sites wiped out, nearly 200 factories destroyed, and U-boat production is majorly disrupted. There are some that have estimated that 26 U-boats aren't built as a consequence because of that raid. Yep. I mean, the scale is completely different, and you can see why the powers that be went down that route. That's not me, as I say, going, this is fine, the death figures, but you can understand why that was a pursued route, and especially the fact as well that both dams are repaired very swiftly. The Mona by September, before the autumn rains come, so that they don't really lose out much. It's quickly back up to speed. And there's a big celebration event that's held in October. They make a big propaganda thing out of this. Look, that we can build back this quickly. Because you've got to think that the bombing campaign is really stepping onto a new foot. As I mentioned, Gomorrah, the scale is absolutely unthinkable to what was happening at the start of the war, and just unimaginable, really. So we talk a little bit as well about output. So industrial output, that's the main thing. The reason to breach this is to deny the water that's used towards electricity, steel, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So as a stat, 15th of May, 1 million cubic meters of water goes to 260,000 after the raid. So that's what they are able to take. That's a significant drop. That's just under 74%. But by the 27th of June, it's back up to 1 million. So it's just over a month, there's that disruption, and the water is found elsewhere. It's not the big sort of disruption that a lot of people think it is. And many of the waterworks nearby are knocked out only for a few days. One at Steele is only out for an hour because of the flooding.
Wow.
So the mass disruption is, the recovery is quite quick. Water. So where? How do they do this? Well, the water is found elsewhere. They take more from the Zorpa Dam, ironically, which makes you, again, think if they had breached that, it would have been more disruptive. They also, the Germans have developed taking it directly from the Rhine itself, which has been only recently developed. If the raid had happened a year before, they didn't have that. It would have caused even more disruption. So there are already a few what ifs here.
Yeah.
But definitely some things to think about. The other thing that's brought in a lot is the laborers that are brought away from work on the Atlantic Wall, the defenses across Europe, and that it's not ready for Normandy and such like. I mean, as a starter, it's virtually impossible to pick exactly where the work would have been disrupted because it's like along the whole coast. Labour has brought in a 20,000. I've seen stats of 60,000. That's not the case. And directly from work from the Atlantic Wall is 7,000. It's a couple of months. And this is before the Atlantic Wall really kicks off the production of making itself. You know, Rommel goes there in early 1944 and goes, right, we need to step things up. We need to take this more seriously. There is a real legitimate threat from the Allies now. So at this point of the war, I don't think it's a very, very strong argument. I've seen it and it's been like, this is the war winning aspect of the dams raid. It's like, I think it's a very, very loose sort of argument. I've managed to trace it back, but yeah.
I think on the whole, if you're, I mean, you know, don't want to put myself into an insane German mindset, but if you're looking at kind of like back up to speed in about a month, you can get the water from other places and things like that. Then you look at, right, am I going to take 7,000 people away from this invasion defense in 1943 when I don't really think an invasion's coming?
No.
Okay. Yeah. It's not that important to build that up.
There's still a lot. I mean, this is before the Battle of Kursk. This is before things on the Eastern Front, North Africa, you know, the Mediterranean, you know, they're still in the balance. There's still things we don't know what's going to happen. I don't think it is a big deal. I've seen figures like, say, 60,000. It was never that much. I don't know where these are coming from.
Yeah.
I think, but this is what I mean by this obsession of wanting to make it bigger than it was. That's not to say that it wasn't a complete failure, but don't make it out like it was a war winning.
Yeah.
Absolutely, you know, defining moment.
Yeah. It isn't the Manhattan Project, is it?
No. I've got thoughts about that as well, but anyway, I won't go into that. But regardless, you compare it to use want of a word, the conventional bombing. So this is what Bomber Command is mostly doing is trying to attack bomb cities and towns. Usually with the idea that there's going to be industrial areas and there's this policy of dehousing as well and morale of the German people and such like is now coming into play. Now, that's training resources in itself. The Germans are building huge concrete flak towers. They're building U-boat pens. They're using concrete for these defences over ports and such like, as I say. Why single out chastise? You know, the whole of the bombing campaign is draining resources. There's no, you know, and those labourers would have come from all over the place. They would have been diverted and such like. It's just this needless sort of putting that raid on a pedestal and ignoring, you know, 99% of what else is going on. And that's a big part of the rage today. It's just like, come on. Don't let it run away with itself. It is an incredible story, but it can't run away with itself. And even in Germany, there's not really a lot thought of it today. It's just like, that happened, you know, and there is a memorial and it was tragic, but the focus is more on what happened in Hamburg and such like. It's a British thing. I imagine the Canadians, Australians involved and such like are as well, but it does seem to be a British focus and memory of the air war. It's not really a predominant one anywhere else, which I found very, very interesting. And as I say, it's not in the wider memory.
I suppose we do an element of this in Britain, as Chris Kempsel pointed out. It's just like you could look at Dunkirk, which we create as this massive victory, when actually what it was just a rout followed by an emergency evacuation.
Well, even Churchill says, you know, we shouldn't take deliverance for victory from this. Wars are not won by evacuation.
Yeah.
I think I've paraphrased that slightly, but because I can't remember the exact quote, but that's more or less it. And he's saying, like, we can't. This is good that we've managed to rescue it, but it's not a victory. It is a defeat. We need to move on from this, you know, and it's just like, how has it walked into this victory? Anyway, I'm going to go into another rant now.
How because I know you want to kick off about the film a bit, so here we go then. Yes. So how have the raid and its subsequent portrayals then kind of influenced or hindered our understanding of Bomber Command?
I think the film, more than anything, has definitely done this. It's a great film. I won't lie. It's a really interesting film. There's some great moments, some great performances in it. There's a fair amount of nonsense in it as well, but you expect that from films. I think as well that there's another film that comes out in the 1950s called Appointment in London, which is based heavily on Bernard Cheshire, who later led 617 Squadron, mm-hmm. one of Victoria Cross, for those who don't know. And it talks about the development master bomber. It looks at things such as combat stress and such like and dealing with loss. But I don't think it lives in British memory because it is bleaker. It's a more honest sort of story. You also see the German perspective. You see the Luftwaffe defences. Okay, you don't see the people being killed on the ground. But the dam busters, I think you've got a couple of factory workers running away safely from the flood and a train being toppled over, and that's the enemy. so it's very much distancing. It's very much, I almost want to say a clean attack. Yeah. You know, so I've got issues there, and I think that adds to it. The idea as well that, you know, it got special attention by the press's nonsense as well. Yeah, you have the members of the royal family visiting the air crews afterwards. Yeah, you have VCs, you have decorations, but though and newsreels, but these happen with other raids. I've talked about the Augsburg raid. You know, you've got the king visiting battle bombers in France. You've got lots of different visits happening and anything that happens, it's celebrated in the war. I think that again is looked through as sort of, oh, look at this, and just ignoring sort of like, well, no, that's what they did. I mean, it was a PR success. It was good for morale, but virtually every raid, an unusual one was like, yeah, we went and bombed Berlin tonight. Good, you know, and it would be in the newsreels and everything. Largest raid yet by the RAF, et cetera, et cetera. They were all touted. They all had visits from important people, you know.
Between Dunkirk and 6th of June 1944, you're going to publicise any win you get, aren't you?
Yeah. And I don't think there's anything really bigger than the dams raid. I don't think there's anything big about, should I say, the dams raid that differentiates that. There's also this idea that all of the crews were handpicked by Gibson. Well, the flight commanders were, but the rest was kind of like, you know, it wasn't quite done like it is in the film. Mm. And it's not, this is the thing that I have an issue with elite units, which I think adds spice to it as well. Yes, the squadron is formed for the dams raid, but when it's over, they're like, oh, what do we do with them now? You know, it's
give him to Leonard Cheshire and get on with it.
You know? Get on with things. But I mean, yeah, you have raids, you have ops, I should say. That was the term at the time where crews are picked. Also, the other thing about, oh, it's low level, it's so different. Five Group, which, you know, they are Five Group, regularly did low level missions over water, dropping mines, which is a huge campaign Bomber Command run from the start of the war to the end of the war.
Yeah.
So that's not new either. And that's why Five Group are used for a lot of the low-level stuff, because, like I mentioned, Dortmund Ems Canal earlier, and actually that's the target that the 617 go for after the dams raid, quite a while afterwards. I can't remember, September time. And it's a disaster. It's an absolute disaster, and members that were on the original raid are lost on it. And again, there's questions of what do we do with these? And that's the other thing that overshadowing is 617 Squadron did lots of other stuff. You know, they sink the Tirpitz. And I also should add 9 Squadron were involved with that. They were dropping the specialist tall boys and bombs and such like. So it's not just 617 Squadron that are doing these sort of things either. Mm. And I don't know, it's just... So I've kind of gone off tangent a little bit. But
the exasperation in your voice here is just diamond. It really is.
But, you know, we've got this thing, and it does fit into this British sense of stoicism. And yeah, I think there's an element of jingoism as well with it, with the stirring music and everything. And it's kind of just fed into a form of national identity. And I think it's become the air war memory now, more so than the Battle of Britain. Even. Yeah. I think we're seeing a shift here. And I mean, without going into too much about it, but the protection over Scampton, well, actually 617 Squadron were at Woodhall Spa for longer, but there's no hoo-ha about that. It's just that the dams raid was at that airfield. Yeah. But it's, oh, we've got to preserve it. And it's just like, yeah, there is something about this that is captured. And I just think it's just, come on, as I say, let's talk about other squadrons. Let's talk about other ops. Let's look at the bigger picture.
Well, let's do exactly that then. So yeah. So beyond the Dam Busters raid then, what are some of the key operations that are carried out by Bomber Command, and how did they contribute to the war effort? Any lesser known ops that have had a significant impact, and how?
There's ops, there's campaigns, there's all sorts. I mean, I'm going to bang my drum that is my MA dissertation about Bomber Command in the Battle of Britain. The general narrative is, oh, before 1942, Harris comes in February, they were useless. This is all to do with a report that's made in 1941 that says that they're not hitting their targets. There are issues with the report. It's not perfect. There are definite issues with the tech not quite coming in and strategy and such like. But you can't dismiss everything before there, because there's massive learning curves and there are contributions. The Battle of Britain, Bomber Command and Coastal Command, I should mention, are initially in the role, Battle of Britain Roll of Honour, which is still in Westminster Abbey. They're listed there. They're removed after the war. I think it's got a lot to do with how the campaign escalated, especially with Dresden, the political fallout, etc. from that. But yeah, they're bombing invasion barges. The Dortmund Canal Raid, as I mentioned, they're attacking Luftwaffe airfields. There is, and it's advertised in newspapers. It's sold of, we're on the offensive. We're not just sitting back and taking it. The Brave Fighter Boys, et cetera, et cetera. The Never in the Field of Human Conflict was so much old speech. The majority of that is talking about the bomber crews. The poster with the pilots on it are bomber crews from 58 Squadron. Which flew right. Whitney's in the battle. There's things like that, and you read accounts of the time, and it's just like, come on, they are the few. But anyway, that's my that's the campaign that they contribute and were considered so at the time.
I suppose really what Bomber Command are doing in the Battle of Britain is pretty much what the Luftwaffe is coming here to do. It's like, take out the airfields, cripple the air war, and yet the Luftwaffe is pinged up as this great threat. Which our episode with James Holland completely destroyed. Yeah. Bomber Command is going back to them and going, well, you're not taking off now because we're just putting a whole load of craters in your airfields.
Well, so I remember there's a sign that's up on a shop that's been damaged by bombs, and it says, this is nothing, you just see what the RAF did to the Berlin branch. you know, it's that sort of hitting back. You know, I mean, that's just all, I don't know, it might be propaganda and such like, but it's still what is being played out. The narrative that is wanting to be discussed is, look, the RAF are on the offensive. As I say, the invasion barges, about 1 in 10 are sunk by Bomber Command, which, when you think about it, that's quite a lot for an invasion force that is being, I mean, okay, we can talk about Sea Lion and whether it was legitimate or not. That's a whole discussion.
I know, we've got a rage on that. You know,
fair. Even so, for a force that, you know, is dubbed useless before 1942, it does hit stuff. It's just learning. I mean, the Luftwaffe isn't particularly hitting many targets either. It's making mistakes and getting lost and, not doing a lot of damage and such. Yeah. Like,
challenge anybody to drop 50 tons of stuff from 20,000 feet at night and land it in the right place.
Yeah.
Anyone.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is you look at the scale, you look at the Blitz, and obviously it is horrific, and my grandparents are in London in the Blitz. The scale is nothing compared to once the heavy bombers come in, and once, you know, the RAF develop target markers and such like master bombers and the H2S and all the rest of it. The bombing war escalates. And at the peak of it, you could probably argue, is in Japan, when you have a firebombing of Tokyo and then the atomic bombs, the destruction there is just... wow, beyond your imagination, really. Other operations, Raid on Peenemünde, Operation Crossbow, the film. This is the attack. Well, there's two elements to it. You've got the raid on the V2 development site on Peenemünde, which is successful. It's very costly, but it does delay V2 production. Mm-hmm. There are various estimates about how long it is, but even so, it does shake things up and force distribution of V2 and delay the development. There's also a second element which comes after D-Day, after Overlord, where there are the bombings of the V1 launch sites and such like. That's another one I think we need to talk a little bit more about. Again, it's not without contention. A lot of French civilians are killed because a lot of the sites are in the part of Calais, especially the V1 ones.
I went to one at Epalac. In fact, they've basically strung up the bomb that came through the top because it didn't go off. So they've strung it up from the ceiling underneath the original hole it came in. which was Epalek Blockhouse, and that thing is huge.
Yeah.
But that was one raid when we realised where it was. I think it was before even Epalek really managed to launch anything. The RAF went, right, there it is, drop it, and done. It's out of the war. It never fired a shot.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Gosh. But yeah, the other thing is, and I've spoken about this, is Operation Overlord. There's deception operations. 617 Squadron is involved in deception operations and such like. Bomber Commander blocking what is left of the German Navy, the E-boats. It's mining the ports and bombing them. There's the transportation plan as well. It's destroying lines of communication. There's troop support. Okay, it's not. There's a lot of contention over that because there are elements of friendly fire and such like, but it is actively involved with that. And you look at the wider picture. It's not just about bombing beaches. It's about a wider campaign to assist in Operation Overlord. And that includes obviously the V1s, the V weapons as well. You've got to, one that I want to mention, Operation Oyster I've talked about, which is a raid in the Netherlands of Philips work, Eindhoven, which produces one third of all radio valves for the Nazis.
Cool.
That is out of action for 6 months. That is a significant hit on, and this demonstrates that, yeah, these targets can be hit. Again, we talk about the Tall Boy, the Grand Slams, the sinking of the Tirpitz, Dortmund Ems Canal. We have Cheshire, again, 617 Squadron, again, here, diving into factories and dropping flares and such like to make sure that it's hit. And obviously he wins a VC over the course of all of his service with Bomber Command. But this is absolutely incredible things, the development of the Master Bomber and getting more precise. And obviously the overall campaign draws lots of resources away from the Eastern Front, from the Mediterranean, from North Africa, from Normandy, et cetera, et cetera. It's a wider thing that we can definitely talk about. Things I also want to talk about, I mentioned the raid on Augsburg as well and things like this. There are attempts to do different things throughout the war. The Dam Busters isn't a standalone attempt to do something different. There are different approaches and let's see what works. So yeah, that's a little bit more of a rant about some other things. I mean, there are loads of others. I could
carry on. If you're on a roll, you go for it. Yeah.
But yeah, it's good to get off your chest.
Feel better?
Yes.
Okay, so we talked a bit about the impact of Dresden back in Series 6 with Steve Darlow and that there was more to Bomber Command in Dresden. Now, you mentioned in kind of our earlier conversations and things like that how the Dambusters raid is kind of used to counter some of the Bomber Command controversies. Mm-hmm. How?
I think it's a case of looking at it and it feels cleaner. Then when you look at Dresden, when you look at firebombings of numerous towns and cities that happened, it's, look at this. It's destroying a dam which has got guns on it, yes, but it's not bombing people. Except, and I think that's used by one side of an argument. As I said earlier, there's this binary approach to it. Likewise, Dresden is, look, that's just what Bomber Command did. No, it's not. And that escalated over a long period. I know we're going to talk about the early war and such like at some point, but that's something else that needs to be considered. There is a much wider narrative. That's not me supporting it or anything, but that's me saying to understand how it happened. It didn't happen overnight. And also, with Dresden, there is this politics because Churchill's involved and such like, and the controversy over the campaign medal and memorials and such like. I definitely think Dresden is a key factor, and that's his Churchill's moment where he turns his back on Bomber Command. And I think that's why it's played up so much. And that is used as a counterpoint for the dams raid, where it is the opposite. It's like, well, look how incredible they were. And as I say, that the film has a lot to answer for as well. I think that's a big factor.
Over here and look at this thing where only three German people died, but we took out the dams. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. As I say, there needs to be more appreciation of the context of the time as well, and how these things escalated. And I also think some of the narratives as well with the dam busters, that there isn't a German voice in the film. I think as well, that's kind of like a way of distancing it. I think I recently was on a podcast talking about Bomber by Len Dayton, which was a book and then a radio adaptation, which tells it from multiple perspectives. And it shows the bravery of the air crews. It also shows that, you know, what was happening on the ground. It doesn't deny Nazism. It also questions the clean Luftwaffe myth and all this sort of stuff. It is incredible. And I think it's more powerful to tell that wider story, which the Dam Busters film doesn't do. And I think some people jump onto it. And I think the way that we look at the bombing war needs to be more inclusive. I think it's happening, but it does still annoy me that there is still this absolute fascination with the dams raid. And the other thing to remember as well is a lot with the bomber crews is a lot signed up wanting to be Spitfire pilots after the exploits of the Battle of Britain and all the rest of it, and ended up as tail gunners on a Lancaster.
Which is exactly what you don't join the RAF to do.
Exactly what you don't join it for. But that's what's needed. The air war is about the bombing war when it comes to Britain.
Yeah, because at their core, broadly speaking, the biggest use of fighters is to protect bombers, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's naturally you can defend fighter crews. You can defend fighter pilots, should I say, because they're up there stopping the bombers. The bombers, it's more questionable, especially once the war's over. During the war, it's, oh, look at the bombers going over there and causing disruption and all the rest of it. But that does change, especially how the war escalates. And the figures, as I say, some of these raids are just, I can't get my head around that many people being killed. It's just, gosh. And the numbers within Bomber Command themselves, 55,000 out of 125,000.
That's almost a 50% fatality rate. Because, you know, does any other service or branch of service really have that?
The only one that is higher than that are German U-boat crews.
Right.
So it's the worst for the Allies
by a long shot. Yeah. Wow.
Which is quite a sobering thought. And of course, it varies throughout the war, depending on the campaign. So if you're flying a Lancaster, I don't know, or...
Other bombers are available.
Other bombers are available, he says, wearing a Lancaster t-shirt. you're flying in that, I don't know, at the end of the Battle of Berlin, where the loss rates are escalating and you have the worst night of the Royal Air Force, where more RAF personnel killed in about an hour and a half than the whole of Fighter Command lost during the Battle of Britain, the Nuremberg Raid, 30th of March.
Yeah.
Yeah, the chances of you surviving then are not very good. But if you're near the end of the war and you come in, or, you know, you've got a higher rate of survival. It's a little bit of, it depends where you're stationed, depends where your missions go. Berlin is a lot more dangerous than, say, milk runs to, as the Americans would say, to France or Holland, or depends what aircraft you're in as well. If you're assigned to one that's old and battered, or even the type of aircraft that you're on. I Halifax 1, I don't have a lot of time for, but the later marks of Halifax were pretty decent bombers. Short Stirling, I do not have a lot of time for either, because it can't reach the optimal height that's needed to escape flak and such like. Yeah. And it's quite lumbering. You don't want to be assigned to one of them. You'd much rather be in other bombers. So all these factors come into it as well, determine, and where you are in the crew. I mean, the tail gunner is the last place you want to be.
I think ball gunner is probably the one that you don't want to be in. But I wouldn't like to be a tail gunner.
Yeah. Yeah, and I got a quote here, but Dietmar Suss, he says that it was, quote, purely a matter of male nerve and the result of bold technical planning. The targets were carefully selected. And this was in no way mindless terror bombing. And then goes on to link that comes into the mythology with the Dam Busters as well, because it is that different raid, that distancing from the terror bombing. Not that I want to use that word myself, because I don't, you know, but that's something else to consider when it comes to the longevity of the dams raid.
So you mentioned that you wanted to talk a little bit about the early war there. So I'm going to take that off, because probably the most famous or possibly notorious chief of Bomber Command would be Harris. You know, yes. We all know infamous Bomber Harris. But he isn't there at the start. And so, yeah, tell us about that early bombing war then. What's going on? Who's in charge? What works? What doesn't?
So you've got a few commanders that come in. You've got Ludlow Hewitt, you've got Portal, you've got Pierce. And Portal later becomes chief of the air staff, so he becomes, in effect, Harris's boss later on. And Portal is in charge of Bomber Command during the Battle of Britain, rather interestingly as well. But yeah, the early part of the war, there is a conscious effort to not risk killing civilians. The nations, so Roosevelt makes a pledge to Britain, France, Germany, don't bomb civilians. Britain, France say, we're not going to do that. Germany delays it until after it's finished absolutely pounding Warsaw. But we've had the Spanish Civil War. We've had the bombings in China as well, which are absolutely horrific. You get chemical warfare there as well, anthrax being dropped and such. Like, you've got gas being dropped in Abyssinia by the Italians as well. There's a big fear about what the bombing war is going to be. So there is this, let's not let this happen. I mean, you've got theorists like Dewey and such like that say that actually you might not need conventional land warfare because bombers can just go through and destroy infrastructures and that's the end of it, which turns out not to be true. But yeah, it's definitely there, that fear of the bomber. But anyway, there is this conscious effort there not to kill civilians because that means that bombers are going to definitely come over and bomb cities and we don't know what it's going to be like, how it's going to pan out. So you've got crews on missions such as nickel raids, which are dropping leaflets over Germany, basically the leaflet saying, we think it's a terribly bad idea that you're at war with us. Do you want to rethink it? the only targets really in Germany that are attacked with conventional bombs are naval targets. So the RAF launch raids against the ships. And yeah, some of the bombs hit the ships, but they bounce off of them because they haven't developed the right sort of bombs and also the fuse time on them. And they bounce harmlessly into the sea. They're attacking in daylight and most of the bombers are shot out of the sky. So the heavier bombers then fly at night, but the light bombers such as the Bristol Blenheim and Ferry Battles, they fly in daylight. So in the Battle of Britain, for example, you've got Blenheims going over to destroy or attack Luftwaffe airfields in daylight. They're supposed to attack with 70% cloud cover so that they can hide slightly from the fighters and such like. But there are instances where they press on, they go on, and there are incredibly heavy losses. That's not to say that it's a complete disaster because Bomber Command help out in Norway. They also help out in the Battle of France. Dunkirk is an example, we mentioned it earlier, but there are attacks on German troops there, and they're escorted by RAF fighters. There's a learning curve there about how to use bombers, light bombers and fighters to support troops and such like. Okay, that's more developed in the desert, but the big mistakes are made in France with how not to do it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's that development. And then it slowly really escalates. And in 1940, the Battle of Britain, that you then do start get bombing of cities. You have the Blitz, you have the RAF bombing Berlin in August 1940. The gloves pretty much come off in May, June 1940, when the RAF do bomb Germany, but they try to bomb the industrial centre, the Ruhr. Another reason why they didn't was the French were very nervous that if Allied bombers go over and start bombing Germany, France is literally over the border, they're going to get bombed. So that's another reason why they don't do it. But that's really the early stage of the war. But that's another rant I could have done is the term the phony war. It really wasn't, especially not for the Royal Air Force and Royal Navies. And it's a really, really busy time. And the thing that about studying this is you see the development, you see the escalation of the bombing war as there is greater anger at cities being destroyed. Okay, we're going to bomb Berlin harder than you bomb London. Okay, we're going to bomb Coventry harder than you bomb Berlin. And it's just this absolute escalation. And that's where it comes from. It develops and then the tech comes in. So with Britain cut off from the continent, there's a lot of investment in bombers. So Britain develops the strategic heavy bombers, the four-engine bombers. And again, that escalates it to a new scale with the further technology that comes in, the radar aids and different bombs and the improvements that are learned over the course of 39 to 41. and are still being learned even into 42, 43. I mean, yeah, it's a long, long process. But I think that we need to talk about that. We can't just jump in and go, damn busters, Dresden. There's a whole narrative there that needs to be digested and not dismissed, as sometimes it is. God, I've had about three different rants then, haven't I?
Careful, you might not come back at this rate. Okay, well, let's, we talked a lot about like fiery death statistics and things like that then. And not all of Bomber Command's missions or ops actually involve bombing at all, do they?
No.
What can you tell us about those?
The one that immediately springs to mind is Operation Manor. So you've got the Dutch population after the failure of Market Garden and the troops there, and they're still large swathes under Nazi occupation. There's a lot of starvation. There's a lot of, deliberate policies as well, such like by the Nazis. So the RAF, Operation Manor, is about delivering food to the Dutch population and stopping them from starving. And they're flying over and they're getting messages, written on the ground and thank yous and all this sort of stuff and cheering as they're dropping this food, which is a complete contrast to what's happening in other operations. You have Operation Exodus as well.
Yeah.
Near and after the war, which is the POWs returning back. So the Lancasters and Halifaxes and such like are used to bring POWs back home. And that's, you get accounts with that of a lot of crews and people taking stock. They're seeing Germany now. They can take their time looking. It's daylight. They're flying over these cities and they're seeing just what Europe is, what it looks like. Mm-hmm. You've also got to say, I mentioned the leaflet drops earlier. So you would have leaflets dropped on conventional bombing raids, but you'd also have ones that weren't. You know, they were solely there for leaflet raids. And one that I find particularly moving is, if people haven't heard of the White Rose Resistance Group, Sophie Scholl, you might have heard of. Her words were found by the RAF pamphlets. She was German, Munich, from Munich University there. And they were spread by the RAF to say, hey, look, this is your fellow, these Germans speaking here saying this war is not right, end it, sort of thing. And I think that's quite a tribute to Sophie Scholl as well. So, yeah, they weren't all about dropping bombs and such like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Do you feel better?
I do feel better. And I'm expecting a storm from people now.
You look actually slightly exhausted in a bit of a relieved way.
it is a relief. I am expecting some slack. As I say, I'm not completely dismissing the damn buses, but I'm going, it wasn't the be-all and end-all. We need to talk about other things as well.
Yeah. Well, if you'd like to know more about this subject, then James has appeared on many of the podcasts and channels that are friends to us here at Rage Towers. He's been on Fighting on Film and World War II TV, to name but two. And we will have links to all his work in the show notes. And if that's not enough for you, then you can follow him on Twitter at JamesJHistory, where you can no doubt unleash your own firestorm back at him. He is expecting it. Yeah. But once again, James, thank you very much for bringing your incendiary rage to our podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. We would really appreciate any reviews you could leave with us with Apple, Podchaser or Amazon. You can follow us on Twitter at History Rage, or individually, I'm at Paul Vavel and Kyle is at Kyle G History. And then if you're loving this, then please do support us on Patreon. In return for your cherished £5 per month, we will give you early episodes, entry into all of our prize draws, the invite to put questions to future guests, and of course, the coveted History Rage mug. And you can subscribe at patreon.com/History Rage. But until next week, from all of us here, stay angry. Bye-bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.